Right. That's what you were wondering about. So this is part of this project that you've undoubtedly heard about, to try to understand whether or not it makes sense to try to explain features of our observed universe by imagining that we're actually part of a much bigger multiverse. So there are things about the universe in which we live, the part that we can observe, that in some way or another seem unnatural to us. They don't seem like they would be if you had just picked a random kind of universe. The most obvious example is this little pie chart, which is the constituents of what the universe is made of. We are 5% of the universe. All the ordinary matter in the universe is just this little slice, by which we mean atoms and neutrinos and every particle that has ever been detected in any experiment outside Dhamma that has ever been done. 25% of the universe is dark matter, and then 70% of the universe is dark energy, which might very well be the cosmological constant or something else. And if you sort of naturally tried to guess what these fractions should be, this is not the answer you would get. This cosmological constant in particular is much, much, much smaller than it has any right to be. So you might say, well, if the cosmological constant were as big as it had any right to be, then we wouldn't be here talking about it. So maybe there's some sort of multiverse. Maybe eternal inflation happens and there's sort of a landscape of possible low-energy vacuum states and they're conveniently colored here. And maybe in the ones where we can live, the green ones, you get numbers like this. And in all these other ones, they exist, but we can't be there. So there's some selection effect. So even though, this story would go, even though a natural value for the vacuum energy is much, much higher than what we observe, the typical observer in this ensemble does not observe the average value. They observe some nice value they're able to see because observers don't exist when the cosmological constant is too big. Likewise, you might try to explain the early universe in some way like this. This is my own little hobby horse. I do not think that we have explained why the universe is homogeneous and isotropic and why the early universe is so low entropy. It's a very unnatural configuration in which to find the degrees of freedom of the universe. And again, you might try to explain that by imagining that there is a set of possibilities, and in the possibilities where typical observers find themselves, you do actually get some nice evolution from a low entropy Big Bang to a complicated universe like we have today. The problem, of course, one of the many problems with this idea, is that if you're talking about what a typical observer sees in this ensemble, or what is the probability that you will observe something, you want to calculate probabilities, you need a measure on the space of possibilities. So you want to say, how many observers find themselves in the green region versus in the yellow region, or in the red region, or something like that. And the problem with that is that typically the answer in every case is infinity. There's going to be an infinite number of observers who are there, an infinite number are there. And how do you compare? How do you say that, well, that number is infinity and that number is infinity, but this is still 12 times bigger than that, even though both of them are infinite? This is a problem in this multi-universe scenario. It's known as the measure problem. What is the measure on the space of possibilities? And people write very erudite papers trying to address the measure problem. So my attitude is the measure problem is hard, and it might not even have a sensible solution, but we can at least try to understand the very simplest possible case of a situation in which something like this would be interesting. So I'm going to go to the opposite extreme of the multiverse and consider the simplest, smallest possible reasonable universe. And the thing that you should have in your mind here is basically the universe as a box of gas. The universe as a quantum mechanical system that obeys all the conventional laws of quantum mechanics and lasts forever. So the point is that it's an eternal universe, number one. There's no beginning to it or end to it. And number two, that it's finite. And everything is going to flow from those two things. So what does this mean? I'm going to assume, number one, that quantum mechanics is true. That there is a Hilbert space, and the state of the universe is the wave function of the universe that is an element of the Hilbert space, modulo, you know, it's really a ray in the Hilbert space, not an individual element, but that's okay. There's some Hilbert space, there's a state vector that describes the state of the universe. I'm going to assume further, and this is actually a much bigger, less likely assumption in the real world, that this state vector obeys the Schrödinger equation. It's conventional, time-dependent quantum mechanics. Now, why is this a bigger assumption? Well, mostly because this little letter down here, T, right? if you are just thinking of the universe as some quantum mechanical system, that's fine. But the relationship between the fundamental underlying degrees of freedom and space-time is going to be very unclear in general. If we don't have yet a good theory of quantum gravity, how do you know what this T is? How do you know what time is? For example, in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation approach to semi-classical quantum gravity, there is no time parameter here. The wave function just doesn't evolve, and I'll talk about how that fits in. So,
I'm assuming space-time is classical in some
ways. I'm not, no. So,
how are you doing? It might be like ADS CFT, and this is the
exactly. Theory. That's right. So as I was just going to say, what the actual assumption here is that there exists a description of the universe in which the state of the universe is a state vector that has some Hamiltonian and evolves with respect to some time parameter by obeying this equation. It might be very far from obvious what that time parameter is, what the space-time interpretation of the wave function is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but I'm assuming that there exists a description of that form. And again, that might not be true. I'm not insisting that that is the real world, but it's something that we can, it's plausible, we can investigate it.
That's essential in your arguments or not necessarily?
Essential. This is essential. Absolutely essential, yes.
Is H hat allowed to depend on T or
not? No. H hat is independent of time. It's a time-independent Hamiltonian.
Does H have a discrete spectrum?
That is the next transparency. People gotta relax. This is California. Chill out. Dudes. The third assumption is that the Hilbert space is finite dimensional. And in fact, that's even a stronger assumption than I need. Really, what I just need is a discrete spectrum, as Mark was anticipating. That is going to be enough to get... I think I forgot to say something over here. Time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Oh, yes. I wanted to emphasize this word forever. So if you believed in Newtonian classical mechanics, or you believed in Schrödinger's equation in ordinary quantum mechanics, and you weren't preoccupied with notions of space and time and general relativity, and were just thinking about a box of gas or some physical system that had a state vector moving in a Hilbert space, time would not end, right? This equation isn't true for some values of t, it's true forever. So if you start with some initial condition, you can extend what happens into the infinite past and the infinite future. And I'm going to assume that that is true, and that's going to be interesting. So this is what you would have assumed before you knew about the Big Bang, for example. So if you do believe in the Big Bang, which I do, the way to reconcile that with this is to imagine the Big Bang is not a boundary to space-time, that we can, if we understood the theory of everything, continue what happened in the universe through the Big Bang. There was something existing before it, a cyclic universe or some sort of bouncing cosmology or whatever. That's not really interesting. The fact is that it has to be continued for all values of time. Okay. And then the final assumption, which is certainly by no means necessary in the actual world, but it's again not completely implausible, is that the Hilbert space is discrete. In fact, for simplicity, let's say it's finite dimensional. Why would you even imagine that? I mean, very naively, you would say, look, the spectrum of a free particle in empty space is continuous and has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. The universe is a very big place. Probably the universe has a very big Hilbert space, like an infinite number of dimensions. But quantum gravity gives us reasons to doubt that. For example, in a specific region of space-time, you can argue that the most information you can squeeze in there is if you put a black hole there. A black hole has a finite amount of entropy. The idea is that even though a free particle moving in empty space or a collection of free particles might have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, in the real world with gravity, once those particles get to have a lot of energy in a finite volume, they will collapse to a black hole. So in the real world, the argument would go, there's in fact a finite amount of information you would need to completely specify the state in some region of space. And this is suggested to us by black hole entropy and holography. So that's just a vague sort of plausibility argument that maybe a finite or discrete spectrum Hilbert space is worth thinking about. There is a stronger argument that is more specific by Banks, Fischler, and also Dyson, Clevin, and Susskind that says, think about de Sitter space. It's a good thing to think about because our universe in which we live seems to be evolving toward it. And in de Sitter space, there's an entropy for our version of de Sitter space with the cosmological constant we think we observe. The entropy is about 10 to the 120. And they say, well, there's a horizon here, and according to notions of black hole complementarity, you should treat the interior of this causal diamond as an autonomous quantum mechanical system with a Hilbert space whose dimension is 10 to the 120. And the fact that there's other things out here in some semi-classical space-time description is completely irrelevant for us. It's all by itself. That's the whole universe as far as we're concerned, and that's the dimensionality of the Hilbert space. Now, I personally think this is going a bit too far. I don't think we know enough about what is going on to actually go that far, but it certainly might be true, and it's certainly worth taking seriously. And these people recognize that this raises issues, which we will be talking about.
I think Tom Banks recently decided that Hamiltonian had to be time-dependent.
I believe he said things like that, yes. I'm not sure where his own Hamiltonian is very time dependent, so I'm not quite sure where it's landed right now.
Another viewpoint that it should be zero.
The Hamiltonian or the dimension of Hilbert space?
Oh, sorry, zero. Sorry.
Yes, the Hamiltonian should be zero, right. So I am choosing to neglect that possibility for right now. That is a viewpoint. I'll get to other viewpoints later. I'm just sort of very gently motivating the particular case I want to look at. And this, you might have your favorite case and it might be different, but this is the case I want to look at because if we can't understand this case, it's hopeless, right? If we can't understand the case of a finite dimensional Hilbert space obeying the Schrödinger equation with a time-independent Hamiltonian that lasts forever, then it's completely hopeless. So this is, even though no one really wants to advocate that this is the universe, it's certainly worthwhile as an educational tool to make sure we understand this case. I should also just mention a couple things. Number one, I appreciate so many people coming to the audience because I know that in this subject area, even the people who write papers in it don't like to talk about it and listen to other people talk about it. I mean, no other area of physics do you find as many people saying, well, yeah, I wrote a paper about that, but really I'm glad I'm not thinking about it anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So the fact that I don't like to read other people's papers about this. So I'm glad that you're here. Number two, I've kept the talk short. I've underprogrammed it because I think the ideas are fundamentally very simple, although they sort of deviate from our intuition from place to place. So I want participation. I want you to ask questions about it because everything in here is absolutely trivial once you actually understand. Okay, so this is the case I want to understand. Now, there's a problem with this case, and the problem is well known. It goes all the way back to more than 100 years ago, and there's different ways of stating what the problem is. Here's one way of stating what the problem is. I don't think this is the best way. I think I'll tell you what the best way is in a second, but this is a way that is conventionally stated. And that's the problem is Poincaré recurrence. So Poincaré recurrence is just the idea that if you have a classical mechanical system whose orbits in phase space are bounded, so for instance, planets orbiting around the sun, and it lasts forever, then you start the system at one point in phase space, draw a neighborhood around that point, and the orbit of the system will return to that neighborhood infinitely many times in the history of the universe. So it will return arbitrarily closely to wherever it started. It will recur over and over again. And this is true even for discrete time systems. Here's a nice example of a picture of Poincaré being mapped under distortion a certain number of times, and it becomes just noise, and you keep mapping it, and it becomes back to where you started. Again, it's not surprising if phase space is compact, you can't keep going to new places. If you last for a very long time, you're eventually going to come back too close to where you started. There is a quantum mechanical version of the Poincaré recurrence theorem that works if you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, or even if you just have a discrete spectrum in an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So the relevance of this first appeared in the early 1890s, and this guy Zermelo comes along, and Zermelo was thinking about entropy and the H theorem and Boltzmann's version of kinetic theory and his attempts to derive the second law of thermodynamics on the basis of kinetic theory. Zermelo later, of course, became a well-known, accomplished mathematician, made seminal contributions to axiomatic set theory. In 1895, he was a postdoc. He got his PhD in 1894, and he started an argument with Boltzmann that went back and forth in the pages of Nature. And I'm going back to the history because all of the stuff is still happening now with very, very tiny changes of vocabulary. So it's interesting to see what they were arguing about.
Back then.
It's recurring, exactly. It's a very short recurrence time. We're arbitrarily close. So Boltzmann in the 1870s had, he thought, successfully understood the origins of thermodynamics on a statistical basis. Before Boltzmann and Maxwell and Gibbs and people like that, they knew the second law and the first law of thermodynamics, but they thought of them as fundamental laws. Boltzmann said, no, they're actually just statistical laws that are not autonomous, they're not separate by themselves. You can derive the second law of thermodynamics knowing that the system is made of atoms. If you understand entropy as measuring in a coarse-grained sense the volume of phase space, that it corresponds to a set of microstates that are macroscopically indistinguishable, then of course the entropy is going to go up. If you start in some low entropy state, there's not that many low entropy microstates. It will generically tend to grow. And he proved a theorem, the H theorem, that said under reasonable assumptions, he could show that the entropy would grow with time. The second law of thermodynamics was true. Zermelo says, and you should read these papers because they're highly amusing. You know exactly what Zermelo is thinking. He's like, these are famous physicists, yet they don't understand that a function cannot be periodic and monotonic at the same time. If you have a function of phase space, which is the entropy you assign to every given state by just coarse graining it, the recurrence theorem seems to imply that the entropy has to go up and down, it has to recur, it has to be quasi-periodic. But Boltzmann had a theorem that said the entropy will always go up. How could both of those be true? So Zermelo used this to argue against kinetic theory. Zermelo was one of the people who didn't believe in atoms as late as 1895. He said, the second law is a law of nature. It is separate from Newton's laws of nature. It's another law of nature, and I've disproven your proof of it. Your derivation can't be physically relevant because if it were, the entropy would go down just as often as it went up. So Boltzmann responded to this, and Boltzmann understood what was going on very, very well. He had no misunderstandings, but he also had no scruples. So he changed his mind about what the correct response to this was many times. And you can't blame him because we still don't know the correct response to this over a century later. So he came up with several different responses, and they're worth looking at. I'm not going to read every word here, but just briefly, he said, well, maybe the universe has a beginning. This is 1895. He says, maybe what you would expect to be true from Newton's laws of motion is not true. Maybe time had a starting point. The second law would then arise. It could be explained mechanically as a result of Newton's laws if the universe started from a very improbable state. That's a possibility, and then, of course, you just get the second law. Another possibility is perhaps the universe is infinite. There is no recurrence because the orbits in phase space are not bounded. This is sort of the most obvious thing to think, and it is something that we still should take very seriously, and I'm going to argue later this is my favorite version of this. In that case, the Poincaré theorem is just not applicable. But the final response that he had is, okay, maybe all of your assumptions are right. Maybe the universe does have a finite phase space. Maybe it does last forever. Maybe there are Poincaré recurrences, and maybe we just happen to be in a random fluctuation in this finite-sized box of universe. And this is a long thing, but it's worth looking at. So if the universe is finite, if the phase space is finite, then there must be, so it's in thermal equilibrium everywhere and therefore dead. I like that. So the whole universe is dead. There's nothing happening. It's in thermal equilibrium. But because Boltzmann has explained the second law using kinetic theory, he knows that in thermal equilibrium, the second law will occasionally be violated. Very, very rarely you will fluctuate to a system, to a state, a configuration of lower entropy. So, here and there, relatively small regions the size of our galaxy, which we'll call worlds, which during the relatively short time of eons are going to deviate significantly from thermal equilibrium. So he's talking about what we now call the multiverse. He's saying that in this really, really big region of universe, fluctuations happen where the local conditions become very different. And they're different galaxies. He didn't know that there were any other galaxies beside our own in 1895. Yes?
Is before or after Boltzmann's brain?
This is
the
Boltzmann never used the word brain or the concept of Boltzmann's brain.
Well,
that's an argument against what he's saying here.
I thought that, well, the concept was credited to an assistant.
The concept that is credited to an assistant was from an 1893 paper. But the concept, let me explain a little bit. But the point is that he is advocating the possibility. He's raising the possibility that maybe this does happen. The Boltzmann's brain argument is an argument that, no, this doesn't happen, because if it did, then that's the next transparency. Yeah, that's right. And he goes on and explains that you might think this can't be right because half the time the entropy would be decreasing and half the time it would be increasing. But he says that's not right because basically any person living in such a cosmos would always define the past as the direction in time where the entropy was lower. The formation of memories and and evolution and so forth all depends on the change of entropy. So as long as there is an entropy gradient in the universe, we always think the past happened in the past, and we think the future happened in the future, a posteriori. So the reason why this history is worth repeating is all of these are still alive and kicking as possibilities for what actually happens in the universe. And I would love to know which of these is true. So here's the problem with that last possibility. That last possibility is the one we're looking at now. We're looking at a quantum mechanical framework, but it's still the same idea, some finite universe that lasts forever. The problem is that so most of the time you're in thermal equilibrium. If you plot entropy versus time, there's a maximum value and you're usually just there. But there will be, statistically, fluctuations to lower states of entropy. What Boltzmann didn't quite understand, he sort of intuitively knew it, but he didn't have the equations in front of him, is that the probability of a fluctuation goes as the exponential of the change in entropy. The more you lower the entropy by this fluctuation, the less frequent such a fluctuation is going to be. So if you want to explain the universe around us, by this kind of reasoning, you say, well, you basically impose the anthropic principle. You say, we can't live in thermal equilibrium. It's dead, just like Boltzmann said. Nothing ever happens in thermal equilibrium. So in order for us to be here, we need to have a fluctuation down. But that's a theory, and a theory makes predictions, like it or not. And the prediction is that you will be with overwhelmingly large probability in the smallest allowed fluctuation, where allowed means whatever you define allowed to mean. But once you define it, either it's just a galaxy, or it's just a star, or it's just me, once I define what I mean by anthropically allowed, I will predict that the overwhelming majority of observers in this thermal equilibrium universe are going to see just that, and the rest of the universe will be in thermal equilibrium. The first use of this idea that I actually have a reference for is Eddington in 1931, who says the universe containing mathematical physicists will at any assigned date be in a state of maximum disorganization not inconsistent with the existence of such creatures. His slightly overblown way of saying you would see me, the mathematical physicist, and you all would be in thermal equilibrium. That's the strong prediction of this kind of model. And then more recently, Albrecht and Sorbo reduced it to its, you know, the reductio ad absurdum, to the minimal thing you would ever need. And that's a single brain floating around in thermal equilibrium. So you have a set of particles with some Gibbs distribution or whatever it is, and they randomly come together to form a brain that is conscious and sort of looks around and goes, aha, here I am. And then it dissolves back into thermal equilibrium. That's the anthropic cutoff. And you predict that the overwhelming majority of conscious observers in this ensemble are like that. That's the problem. That's why most people think that this model does not work. There are skeptics to this line of reasoning. Figure is taken from a New York Times article about this concept by Dennis Overby. And when the article came out, I was quoted in the article and I received a letter from a skeptic, George Wing, who is 10 years old, and I'll translate because his spelling is not always perfect. He writes, I don't know if you exist, but I do. I do not agree with your article, and I do not believe that mumbo jumbo. If you do, well. It's a disturbing thought, but I know how to deal with it. I will not let the world disappear under my nose, but if you do, I can't say I'm sorry. A 10-year-old who knows a little more than some people, George Wing. P.S., some people have a little too much time. This is for real. I would not lie to you. George Wing's father is a high school science teacher, Michael Wing, who mailed copies of this. He said his son, his 10-year-old son, had never been more agitated when reading the newspaper. When he read, you know, disasters throughout the world, blah, 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 but this Boltzmann brain stuff shook him up. He didn't like it. All right, they're skeptics. George is not the only skeptic. Hartle and Srednicki are also skeptics. The spelling is much better. Yeah.
Maybe not.
They use more equations. So I'm opening myself up here, but I'm going to try to explain Hartle and Srednicki's argument with Hartle and Srednicki in the audience. So grant me 3 transparencies of exposition, and then they can tell me where I went wrong. So here's a simple way of putting what I think the argument is. Consider 2 theories, T1 and T2. And we're going to use Bayes' theorem to judge whether or not we can rule out one of these theories by collecting data and comparing it to the prediction of the theories. So here's Bayes' theorem, simplified a little bit. The probability that a certain theory is correct, given that you collected some data, is up to a normalization factor. The prior probability for that theory, the probability you thought that theory would be right if you had no data at all, which is up to you, maybe you want to justify it, but it's something that needs to be put in to do a correct statistical analysis, times the probability of getting that data given that the theory is right. Okay? So this is really not surprising, and it's nice because it's a theorem. Right? You always feel good when you have a theorem on your side. But Bayes' theorem can't be wrong. It's a theorem. You can prove it. So you cannot possibly make incorrect statements once you have a theorem next to you. So what they say is, so here's a very simple example that is more or less translated from their paper. Imagine that the universe is an infinite string of bits. So instead of all this stuff about space and time and electrons and quarks, we have just ones and zeros, and a string of ones and zeros in some order is the universe. Imagine this simplified model. And I have two different theories of the universe. One theory says, T1 says that every single bit is a one. That's a nice simple theory. Here's another simple theory. The bits are completely random. There's a 50-50 chance for every bit that you're going to get a zero or a one, and there's no correlations between them. They're just a random string of bits. Another fairly simple theory. You might have some priors for which theory is right, but I don't really care. What I would like to care about is, what is this? What do we mean by the probabilities you observe some data given that theory? So let's imagine that we are convinced that one of these two theories is right. We live in a universe made of bits, and we are one of those bits, and we're a one. And we say, we look around us, and we're able, using our technology, to observe 100 bits in our neighborhood. And we observe that every one of those bits happens to be a one. And you would say, all right, that's an observation I made. That's data that I collected. What do you conclude about the relative likelihood of T1, theory 1, and theory 2 based on the fact that I observe 100 bits, all of them are ones around me? So, in yet other words, does this count as evidence against theory 2 and in favor of theory 1? And I think that on the very naive level, at first blush, not surprising, I don't think anyone would argue that probably you go, yeah, that's evidence against theory 2. Roughly speaking, I would say that the probability of getting that data, a string of 100 ones, is 2 to the minus 100. And therefore, this is a small number, and therefore theory 2 is more or less ruled out. Or at least it's very, very unlikely compared to what I would have thought before I collected that data. So Hartle and Srednicki say, no, that's not right. You've made a mistake, and we will tell you what that mistake is. The truth is, we can conclude nothing about the difference in the relative likelihood of these theories just from that observation that our neighborhood consists of 100 consecutive ones. And the reason why is because when we write down Bayes' theorem here, you put a little extra assumption that you didn't explicitly spell out, and that assumption changed what you meant by the probability of getting that data in the context of that theory. They said you should interpret this factor not as the probability that a randomly selected string of bits would all be ones, which in this case would be 2 to the minus 100 for theory 2. Rather, it just means the probability that somewhere in the universe there is a string of 100 ones. All you know from having done your observation is there is one string of 100 ones in a row in the universe. You don't know anything else. And in both of these two theories, the probability that somewhere in the universe there would be a string of 100 ones is unity, right? It's an infinitely long string. You're going to get any arbitrarily long string of ones you want. The reason they say you made that mistake is because you made an extra assumption, namely that you were a typical observer in this universe, that in this string you are distributed randomly, as if we had an ensemble and you'd done many, many different observations, but that's not right. And you might say, but I think I want to be a typical observer in the universe. I think it's a sensible assumption to make, and people write a whole bunch of papers trying to justify the assumption that we are a typical observer in the universe, and Hartle and Srednicki argue against that by saying, if you buy that, it seems to make perfect sense in this case. It seems to not lead us astray, but we can give you other examples where it would definitely lead you astray. So here's the rough argument, and you'll notice that what I'm doing this whole thing, I have a personal philosophy that anytime physicists start using the word conscious observers, they don't know what they're talking about. So I will never use those words. So I think that the only thing that we can do and have confidence in is referring to physical things, not observers and stuff like that. So the way I like to say it is, imagine that we were elements of some set S. You tell me what the set is, and imagine that you could safely assume that we were typical elements of set S. It might be a natural a priori assumption. The problem is that that assumption gives you a tremendous amount of leverage over things about the universe that we have never observed. Much more leverage than we have any right to grant ourselves. So if we notice that we were elements of S that had a certain property X, and there was another property Y, which was exclusive with X, if you were Y, then you were not X and vice versa, then if you assumed that we were necessarily typical, and you noticed that we were X, you'd be tempted to say this is an argument against the idea that there are more Ys than Xs. There are probably more Xs than Ys, because we are typical and we are X. That would be how the argument would go. And this argument leads you to all sorts of conclusions that you have no right to actually conclude. For example, imagine that the set that we're a member of is intelligent beings in the galaxy, let's say, and that we notice that we are humans. So you could say I have two theories, one of which, and this is right from their paper, one of which says that we're human beings, but there's also a race of intelligent gas bags in the atmosphere of Jupiter. And they're just as intelligent as we are, maybe in some senses more intelligent. And there are trillions of them, and that's a theory. And there's another theory that says there are no intelligent gas bags living in the atmosphere of Jupiter. And it says, they say, look, if you believed all this, you would conclude that we, on the basis of data, can rule out the idea that there are 100 trillion intelligent gas bags floating around the atmosphere of Jupiter. Because if there were, a typical observer would be a Jovian, not a human, and we're a human, and therefore that's not right. If you buy this argument, they say, you don't have to look at Jupiter. You can already conclude that there aren't any intelligent beings there. And that you shouldn't be able to conclude that. You need to go look before you can make those conclusions.
Just for the record, there are physicists who accept that conclusion.
I don't. So I'm trying to paraphrase your argument, but this is actually the part that I completely agree with. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Very well.
Let's stop here. Yeah.
I should just declare victory, right. Yes?
Just to compliment your sixth grader, I had a 12th grader who told me, well, what if she thought that the universe itself was just a thought?
Mm-hmm. That's another version of, that's another thing that Hartle and Fricke will tell you not to buy into. Let me tell you why. So there's another argument called the doomsday argument that goes like the following thing. It says, we're human beings. The population of human beings is growing more or less exponentially. So if that exponential growth continues, the typical human being is not alive right now. We're in just a very small tail of a distribution. The overwhelming majority of human beings are going to be born in the future. But if we're typical and we're alive now, that can't be right. So even though we don't know why, the exponential growth of the human population will stop soon. People make this argument. I mean, the peers in print and with papers and referee journals.
They're the same ones who think you shouldn't go to Jupiter.
Yeah, exactly right. So, and I think, this is the point of this, is that this logic that lets you conclude things that you probably are sitting there thinking, I shouldn't be able to conclude. Like, there are fewer Jovians than humans, there are fewer humans alive in 10,000 AD than alive now, is precisely the same logic that let you conclude that theory one was better than theory two. It was a presumption that we were a typical element of this ensemble. So if you don't believe that you can rule out the Jovians without looking at Jupiter, then you can't rule out the idea that we're just a random collection of bits just on the basis that we live in a string of 100 ones. There's another version related to what you said called the simulation argument, which said, well, as soon as I build a computer that can simulate artificial intelligences, then it's easy to make a huge number of artificial intelligences, and the chances are that we're one of them, if we're typical. You can decide for yourself whether you think that that is true. But most relevantly for people in this room, it's also the same kind of argument that you use to make predictions from the multiverse. You say, well, we're probably some typical observer somewhere in the multiverse, blah, blah, blah. Therefore, the theories that are correct are going to be the theories in which local conditions for typical observers have the cosmological constant that we actually have, blah, blah, blah. If you don't buy that kind of argument, You don't buy this argument, then you shouldn't be able to buy that argument. And this calls into question the whole industry of trying to make phenomenological predictions of observable quantities on the basis of the assumption that we live in a multiverse with a distribution of different local conditions. So Hartle and Chernicki say that we shouldn't be able to conclude that. You cheated by assuming that we're typical. And so that is my translation of what you said. So far, so good?
Brilliant.
Okay, good.
You can give our talks
today. Okay. Here is where I disagree with what they're going to say, because they have one little paragraph in there that is relevant to the case of the finite universe, of the universe that, in fact, just does recur. They say, there's no warrant for assuming that we're typical. Well, what does that mean for the idea that there's a recurrent universe, that there's a finite dimensional Hilbert space in which everything just happens again and again, and we're just a thermal fluctuation? Well, it certainly would be true in that recurring universe that at some point it will pass through a state resembling what our universe was like during the Big Bang. So if you say that we have a universe now that's described by a wave function in a Hilbert space with a certain set of degrees of freedom, a certain Hamiltonian, blah, 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 we know, we think we know, that an allowed state of that wave function is one that looks like our Big Bang. Small, very dense, very smooth, very high temperature. So if you just let it evolve, it will pass through every possible allowed state consistent with some coarse set of constraints, and it will eventually look like the Big Bang, and from there, with large probability, it will evolve just as our universe evolved.
I'm going to raise a technical objection.
Okay.
That I disagree with that statement.
Okay. Can you tell me why?
I have a technical discussion. Well, okay, so I'll try to keep this as short as possible. The way the states evolve in a time-independent Hamiltonian is you write down a state which is sum of some coefficients of eigenstates of the Hamiltonian.
Will appear soon, yes.
Those get time-dependent phases.
Yes.
But the magnitudes of mm-hmm. the coefficients
are constant
once and for all.
That will appear soon, yes.
And I don't believe that it's true that, quote, every state can be mimicked by a state with a fixed set of fixed magnitude coefficients of eigenstates.
Perfectly fair. I think that I can argue, there's two things. One is a general thing that is very fuzzy, and one is a more specific thing. So Mark is objecting to the fact that, let me wait two transparencies to talk about that possibility.
Okay,
sure, very good. Duly noted that there's an objection. So the claim would be, and I'm not necessarily going to attribute this to anyone, but the claim would then be that if this were true, then using the logic from the previous slide, this is a perfectly not ruled out or even not counterindicated model for the history of our actual universe. It is true that the entropy fluctuation corresponding to our universe is much, much bigger than you need for any possible anthropic bound, but it will happen eventually, and we observe it, so all you can say is that since it will happen and we observe it, it's consistent with that theory. Whether it's likely if we were typical is not to the point. It will happen, and therefore we have no data against that actually being the correct theory of the universe. So here's why I want to argue that that's not right. That's going a little bit further than I want to be able to go. And again, I don't think that anyone can actually disagree with me, so I think I can't win. You don't want to give a talk where everyone already agrees with you about everything you're going to say before you say it. You want to change some minds. Okay. The point is that we also want to make some predictions for things we've not yet observed. So we occasionally want to say, okay, we live in a string of 100 bits, and they all happen to be ones, but I haven't yet observed the next 10 bits. Am I allowed to make a prediction for what the next 10 bits should be if I haven't yet observed them, given these two theories? Theory one, it's all ones. Theory two, it's random. I claim that we are allowed to consider ourselves typical within the set of people who observed 100 ones. And let me put a little quantitative meat on those bones. This is, again, a version of Bayes' theorem. This is the version of Bayes' theorem you would use if you had two separate sets of data, D1 and D2, and you want to know what is the probability that theory I is correct, given that you have observed both D1 and D2. Well, guess what? It's the prior times the probability that you would get data 1 in that theory times the probability that you would get data 2 if that theory is right and you know you have already observed data 1. So this is the relevant equation to use when you're faced with this case. And we now want to know, what does this mean? We had a little hermeneutic discussion about what that means, and we said it makes sense to say this means, what is the probability that somewhere in the universe data 1 is right, given that theory. But should we now interpret this as saying somewhere in the universe data 2 is right? And I'm going to argue no. The right way to think about this factor is now, given all the cases where data 1 is correct, imagining that we have a measure on the set of cases, the correct thing to do is to calculate this probability as the fraction of instances where data 1 is right in that measure that data 2 is also correct. Not whether or not it appears somewhere, but actually the fraction of times. Because we haven't yet observed that, we can assume that we are conditionally typical, because that's the only assumption we can possibly make. I would go further and say we kind of always do make this assumption whenever we do statistical mechanics, whenever we don't know what the microstate of some thermodynamic system is. Subject to the macroscopic constraints, we assume a uniform distribution over all the microstates, Laplacian indifference to all the different possibilities. The nice thing about this is not only can we assume it and does it seem like the sensible thing to assume, but it doesn't lead us to any absurd conclusions whatsoever. Assuming conditional typicality, assuming that we are a typical instance of what we have already observed, does not tell us anything about the number of Jovians or the future population of humanity or whether or not you're in a simulation or anything like that. So I think that number one, this is sensible, and number two, it's the thing you would guess you should do, and number two, it's safe from any absurdities like you were led to by assuming typicality in the broader sense before.
Sean, is there any correlation between D1 and D2?
Yeah, there could very well be.
So D1 could be a subset of D1, D2, for instance.
No, there could be a correlation in the sense that the likelihood for D2 could depend on whether D1 is true or not, but they're independent measurements. Okay. They're measurements that I could or could not take separately.
So P of D1 given T, is that, are you going to compute that the way Jim and I would compute it and say it's 1?
That's fine, yes.
Could I ask you a question about Bayes' theorem?
Yeah.
In the usual proof of Bayes' theorem, if the number of possibilities is finite, then it's very easy to prove Bayes' theorem. We just draw some Venn diagrams on set theory. If the set, the diagrams enclose finite number of points, and we just count the number of points, the denominator is always well-defined. Now, do I have to worry when the number of possibilities are infinite? Because in your examples, you always have that kind of subtleties. Like, for example, in your example, you do observe 100 ones in a row.
Yeah.
Now, if I know that the number of the string of bits is, in fact, finite, I don't care how big it is, let's say 1,000, 10,000, then if I observe 100 ones, I know that it's very unlikely that the random theory is right. You know, the theory 1 is correct.
That's right.
Right? Because I have a well-defined denominator, I can define it.
Well,
but
no,
then you use the argument. The argument you use is implicitly using the string of bits as infinite, because you say somewhere in that infinite strings you have...
I don't think that's right, actually.
Okay.
I mean,
so do I have to worry? I mean, is there a proof of Bayes' theorem on the number of possibilities?
Well, so the operational answer to your question is the assumption of everything I say and the assumption of everything that Jim and Mark say is that these make sense. That you have a theory, you have a measure in which you can define these, and everyone agrees on what they are.
So is there a proof of that theorem when, I mean, since you said the theorem is golden, when number of possibilities is infinite? There is such a proof.
Which possibilities? Do I need the T's?
No. The
T's.
For example, we assume infinite number of strings.
Yeah, if there's basically a one-line proof of Bayes' theorem that applies as long as T and D are reasonably well-defined.
But I'm more worried by you made this other statement that everything I said relied on this being infinite. So that's not right. If this string were 10 to the 10 to the 10 digits long but finite... Jim and Mark are going to say, this is still 1. It's not 2 to the minus 100. Wait, 1 minus epsilon, where epsilon is really tiny.
No, but suppose that string is only 1,000
Well, yeah, then you might not find any.
Then you observe 100 bits that are ones that would strongly favor one theory. Right.
Absolutely, sure. Okay. Because then you might not find any. They're just saying that you should interpret this as the chance that somewhere in that string there is.
In our paper, we did define that case, right? And showed how.
No, I'm worried about the infinite case.
That's right. And showed how, right, when you get the larger and larger values of the number of bits you approach it. So there's some, then the argument that it is going somewhere less than.
Some limit, okay.
Yeah, I think it's not, yeah. That's not a deal breaker. There might be deal breakers, but I don't think that one's it, yeah.
So if I treat D1 and D2 together as, say, one full set of data, D3, and I try to evaluate, let's say, T1 and T2 using the equation here versus your previous one on the full set D3, I should get the same results, is that?
Well, not exactly. You would think. But I think the statement in that case would be, I mean, we're making a distinction between what we already know and what we haven't yet measured. Mm-hmm. And so you're moving something that we say we haven't yet measured to the set of things that we already know, and that changes the status.
Okay, but in some sense, it seems like...
It is true that once we haven't yet measured it, you know, then once we do measure it, we know it, and then we would redo the calculation.
No, but in some sense, the likelihood of T1, the likelihood you would assess for theory 1 versus theory 2 depends sort of on the order in which you either collect the data or you evaluate the data, where you think of it as one data set versus two data sets.
I think that's true. I think that in this way of thinking about it, that's just true.
As far as I know, it does end up and everything gives the same answer. This is why you have conditional probability.
No, it won't work in this case.
In this case, it doesn't work. I mean, if everything is finite and sensible, and the point
small.
Is...
Small. By finite, it's small.
Well, clearly there's an equality that you can derive from this, right? You assume the left-hand side is independent upon interchange of 1 and 2, but the right-hand side, you know, is clearly
dependent.
So you have some equality you can derive.
Yeah, but it's not in this case. This case is kind of special.
I'm making a proposal for how to think about
That's
this
right.
situation,
yes.
Which will not respect a swap of
exactly right.
D2.
D1 and D2 are not the same because D1 we already know, D2 we haven't yet measured, and those are ontologically distinct.
He's treating those as fundamentally different
exactly
objects
right.
that cannot be exchanged.
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's let me open Pandora's box.
Of course.
Say the Monty Hall problem.
Yep.
It's the same issue, right?
Yeah, the reason why the Monty Hall problem is a problem is because in order to make people give the wrong answer so that you can... Oh, the Monty Hall.
There was also in the New York Times recently.
Monty Hall problem says you're doing, let's make a deal. You have three doors. You don't know what is behind any three doors, but the host of the show, Monty Hall, does know. And you pick a door. And after you pick a door, so you have a 1/3 chance of getting the car versus a pile of straw. Okay? You want the car. You don't want the pile of straw. Exactly, right. So Monty Hall says, after you pick door number 1, for example, without loss of generality, Monty Hall says, okay, I'm going to open door number 3, and he shows you there's straw in door number 3. And then he asks you, do you want to switch your choice? If you thought that Monty Hall was just randomly opening doors and he could have opened a door with a car behind it, then it wouldn't matter. You shouldn't switch. But if you thought that Monty Hall knows where the car is and he's never going to show you the car, then you should switch. Because then there's a 2/3 chance that behind door number 2 there's a car. I'm not sure what the relevance of that is to that, but yeah. Let me keep talking because it's no longer true that my talk is short. It's now long. Let me assume that this is right. Let's chase through what the implications of this are. That given that we know a bunch of data, we haven't yet observed this other bit of data, we can assume that we're typical, that we are randomly selected among people who've already observed data 1. Well, in quantum mechanics, there is a measure. So this is the only technical part of the talk, and it's technical in a sense which I will soon tell you is kind of not very helpful. But if in this particular situation, when you have a finite dimensional Hilbert space, and you have a Schrödinger equation, and you're evolving according to a Hamiltonian, starting from any particular initial state, an absolutely well-defined measure on the space of all the other states you will ever evolve into is defined by the evolution under Schrödinger's equation. So to see that, so there is a subspace of Hilbert space in which the evolution is ergodic. It covers uniformly every little bit of that constraint subspace. So to see that, and Mark already started giving this part of the lecture, expand the wave function in energy eigenstates. energy eigenstates are nice, and this is something I wish they'd explained to me when I took sophomore quantum mechanics. I always wondered about this. Like, if you have an energy eigenstate, it always stays in the same energy eigenstate, and if you have a superposition, the amplitudes stay the same. Under this expansion of a real valued amplitude, positive number, times some phase, if these are an energy basis, the time evolution of psi is just that the phase rotates, the phase changes linearly in time, given by the frequency, the energy eigenvalue of that eigenstate. So the states just sit there and their relative phases change, and all of quantum mechanics is perfectly trivial. The reason why all of quantum mechanics is not perfectly trivial is because usually you don't know what the energy eigenstates are. You usually know what the eigenstates of some free Hamiltonian are, for example, and you would like to know what the true eigenstates are, but you don't, so you use perturbation theory, et cetera, et cetera. If you actually had the God's eye view of all the energy eigenstates of the system, and given a configuration, you can say this is its expansion in terms of energy eigenstates, all of quantum mechanics would be trivial. It would be like an integrable classical system. So to see that, take this and take out the coefficient of the first energy eigenvalue. Who cares? It's an irrelevant phase. And then you have this state, complete time-dependent evolution, in terms of n independent phases in an n plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space. And they just describe a torus. All of these phases, phi I for I equals 1 to n, the state just evolves through them. And if the frequency differences, omega naught minus omega I, are all incommensurable, if they're not rational multiples of each other, you will fill this torus absolutely uniformly. It's just geodesic motion in a flat torus. It could not be simpler. The point of this is that that evolution gives you a measure on the space of possibilities. There's no more ambiguity. If you can ask any question you want in principle about how likely in the eternal evolution of this state are you likely to observe this and this and this? And you can get an answer. So what Mark was saying before was, of course, these prefactors, these amplitudes, don't change. So it is certainly not true that you can say, I reach everywhere. There's an ergodic subspace. The space of states that you reach are the space of states that you can get to by just changing the phases and not the amplitudes. But again, in the real world, since the actual energy eigenstates are very, very complicated, you can get a lot of places just by changing those phases.
Is your ergodic subspace dense?
No. It's a measure zero. Yeah. So you fill the ergodic subspace densely. But the ergodic subspace itself is in some 2n-dimensional space. It's an n-dimensional submanifold. So it's very small.
Let's see, is this a profound statement or a trivial statement?
Both.
Because even in the case, really simple case in which n equal to 1,
yeah.
Right, obviously the coefficient of the second term to the first term will always be Ri.
That's right.
So I'm going to vary. So you're never ever going to cover some other, right?
No, you cover the circle.
You cover the circle,
yes.
But you never cover the all possibilities.
That's right. That's what I just said. Yes.
Right.
So in general, the state space in quantum mechanics locally looks like an n-dimensional sphere times an n-dimensional torus in the generic case. The torus degenerates on certain boundaries, right. et cetera.
Right.
But you don't move in the sphere.
Right.
There are n conserved quantities
right.
for motion in n plus 1 dimensional Hilbert space.
Right.
And there are n phases that move, that
right.
change.
Right.
And that's perfectly general, okay. And in that sense, it's trivial.
Right. I agree.
Okay, this is the absolutely true statement that is sort of gives you the flavor for what is going on, but is technically, practically not that useful because we don't know what the energy eigenstates are. What about in the real world where we want to know a little bit more? Well, and here I start, and I had to wave my hands a little bit, and this is why it takes me so long to actually write the paper on this, because I'm trying to figure out how careful I can be. But what we generally think about is some set of degrees of freedom, XA, with conjugate momentum PA, and there's a Hamiltonian, there's a free Hamiltonian, there's an interaction. We imagine that perhaps the interaction is small. The crucial claim to everything I'm going to say is that what you expect from the kind of logic that gave you that ergodic result on the previous page is that over very long times, any state that you start with, over very, very long times, if you randomly look at it, will look thermal with respect to eigenstates of the free Hamiltonian. What does that mean? That means that if you start with some density matrix for the system, you give me whatever density matrix you want, or at least some generic density matrix, and I calculate correlation functions of some observable quantities at different times, and the times are very far away from the initial time, either to the future or the past, then as those times get further and further away, the generic expectation is that this correlation function looks the same as the correlation function would look in some thermal state at some temperature.
So where beta is determined in some complicated way in terms of roll path, right?
Exactly right, yes. Beta is the effective temperature that you could get just by looking at the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, for example.
Is this a formula complicated, or is it not?
It's just the you would compute the expectation value of the energy, and that would be the usual thermodynamic relation between energy and temperature.
Okay. And so all this is saying, this looks like I'm waving my hands a little bit, and the point is that this is something that is, again, no one would disagree that this is true, but it's hard to prove in interesting cases, which is why I can't really give you proof of it. But really, all this is saying is that if you have a box of gas, and the little particles in the gas interact weakly, you can put them in the box, and you can put them in any spectrum of initial energy you want. You can have like a delta function, like they're all at some energy, but their motions are random, so it's a kind of a generic state up to that constraint. And you let it evolve forever, and you come back and you open it up, it's going to look thermal to you.
Isn't there some force gradient statement that's involved in the definition of the box, because the time scale is very long?
Well, this is you're taking the limit as these are a long time after you set up the state.
So is there any operator sign you can choose?
Yeah.
I think you have to be careful about what you mean by any operator. If by any operator you mean something you've made out of the X's and P's in some relatively simple way.
Sorry, yes.
If by any operator you mean you're going to write down a matrix in the energy eigenstate representation and you're going to pick every matrix element by hand yourself, then no, because you can always pick things that won't do.
So what's the actual statement?
There's a condition on the phis, and this becomes...
There are closely related theorems in quantum chaos.
Right, that's why you're cited here. Not just to get on your good side, you actually made a contribution.
Which say things that are basically equivalent to Sean's statement, provided the phis are h-bar independent functions of the classical coordinates of momentum.
So what I'm trying to say is that what you expect is that if you took these phis to be, for example, the initial weakly interacting degrees of freedom, you expect this to be true. That's the case that I care about. You could certainly cook up examples of things to observe that would not become thermal. But the thing you cooked up would depend on the initial state, which you presume you don't know. So if this is true, so this is the part I would love to be able to prove something more relevant more generally, but I can't quite do it yet. But if you go with me and assume that this actually works, then you learn something. So let's accept that. There might be some constraints, there might be some effective chemical potentials in this thermal density matrix. And let's say that you have done this measurement, you know the data D1, you know that we're a human being, not a Jovian or whatever. What can you conclude about the probability that you're now going to observe the new data, D2? Given that you believe in theory I and D1. Well, here's a way to think about it. Split up the Hilbert space, this finite dimensional Hilbert space, into the system and an environment. And so I should have mentioned before that the difference between this sort of long-term thermalization and what you might be more used to is that we're not hooking up the universe to a heat bath. We're not exerting it to any external influence. It's a closed quantum mechanical system evolving under Schrödinger's equation. So it's a slightly more profound statement that over long terms it begins to look thermal. So when I split up system and environment, this is the universe. The universe as a whole is a closed system. The system is some little thing that I'm going to say we have access to. We know what state the system is in, and we want to ask what state is the environment in. Given that the system has some properties, if I then look at the environment, what should I see? The answer is you're going to see a thermal state. So what the sort of intuition that you have here is that the universe is big, and you have some little part of it, the whole universe looks thermal, it's in some approximately thermal density matrix, and you say, okay, given that it's in an approximate thermal density matrix on large scales, let's conditionalize over the statement that some little piece of it is in some certain state. That state might be wildly non-thermal. But I want to then ask, what does the rest of the universe look like? So imagine a box of gas and particles are just bouncing into each other, overall thermal, and I want to say, look only at the times in the evolution of that thermal gas that within this little box, the gas molecules have arranged themselves into a relic image of the Mona Lisa. Okay, something very, very non-thermal. But what would I then be able to conclude about the rest of the large, large system? The answer is nothing. The answer is it would still look thermal. The fact that the Mona Lisa is in there is very, very unlikely in this thermal gas, but it doesn't tell me anything about the rest of the system just because I got that unlikely result. And you can actually do this in some simple examples. The point is that given some specific state of the system, you trace out over the system in that state, the density matrix for the environment is still going to look thermal. What does that mean? That means that for our problem, an eternal ergodic universe, we have precise knowledge of some small subsystem. You can infer almost nothing about the state of the rest of the universe. So the question then becomes, what is that subsystem of which we can claim some knowledge? And you might have thought that in the case of the actual universe in which we live, what we know is a lot about the macroscopic history of the universe. We know that the universe had a Big Bang about 14 billion years ago. There's 100 billion galaxies. It's more or less homogeneous and isotropic on large scales, expanding, et cetera, et cetera. There was a person named Edwin Hubble, and he went to a telescope and took some pictures and all that. So my claim is no. You don't know any of those things. What you actually have access to is some records. You have a brain, and you have some textbooks, and you have some, an internet connection, and you can look and say, oh, look, there's a photograph of Edwin Hubble, and I conclude from this photograph that there was a person named Edwin Hubble, and there he's at a telescope, and et cetera, et cetera. You conclude all of those things from your local data, but your local data are very local. Your local data are something very small, and it's sort of pointless but fun to argue over what it really means. It means either just you or just this room, what you're immediately looking at right now, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm asking the question, given, let's say, everything in this room, given that I'm here, you're here, we all have our memories of the past, et cetera, et cetera, we think that there's something outside called the KITP, we think there's something further out there called the Pacific Ocean. If the universe is described by this theory, where it's ergodically evolving from finite-dimensional space, and I have this knowledge here inside the room, what is the chance that when I look outside I will see the Pacific Ocean? And the answer is infinitesimally small. With overwhelming probability, in that setup, what I will see is a thermal spectrum of photons at a temperature, for example, at 10 to the minus 33 electron volts, if the cosmological constant is really what we think it is. And all I'm saying here, in classical GR language, it actually becomes a little bit more clear. We have a big space-like hypersurface of the universe, and we have some small subset of the universe, and this small subset includes a bunch of memories and records and textbooks about the rest of the universe, and we were trying to ask the question, are those records reliable tracers of what's going on in the rest of the universe if we don't know anything about the environment? And the answer is clearly no. The place of the universe in which we can reliably reconstruct what happens is the future and past domain of dependence of that little region S. So if that little region S is measured in meters, the time which we can successfully predict the future or remember the past is measured in, smaller than a microsecond. Yes?
So this sounds just like basically saying that we are Boltzmann's brain, and if so, then everything's a mess just outside.
That's exactly right. So what I'm saying is that the mistake is to conditionalize over universes that look like a conventional Big Bang. We have no right to do that. All we can conditionalize over is the fact that we're here in this room and we think we have evidence that the universe has a certain conventional history. If we have that evidence, but this is the scenario, that evidence is almost overwhelmingly likely to be a fake.
I don't like that theory. I'm going to sign it a really low
crime. The theory is that you're evolving ergodically. That's the theory.
No.
Yes.
The state was randomly selected in some sense.
The initial state?
Yeah. You didn't tell me your theory of the initial state. My theory of the initial state is that we are really, it's one of those states where we're really going through a real Big Bang. It's really out.
No. That's okay. That state will also go through an infinite, you know, this whole, it will recur.
And we're not in those recurrences.
That, no, you have no right to say that.
I do. It's my theory.
No. That's not part of the theory. The theory is a specification of what the universe does. The data you have available to you. No, I think there are rules. There are rules to the game. And we can talk about that later, but I should finish up soon.
But in reality, aren't we anyway seeing and dwelling in this massive thermal equilibrium, and it's just this small bit of sensory apprehension data facility or system that we have? We see with our physical apparatus the ocean, but really what is happening is that massive thermal equilibrium.
I hope not.
We are
not
in that massive. I
think we're very, very far away from thermal equilibrium.
But back to Boltzmann and the original stuff you have on the board is that there is this massive thermal equilibrium with a few little bumps in it. But at the same time, the thermal equilibrium doesn't completely cease at the bumps in the thermal equilibrium, the small.
That's right. So in this scenario,
the bumps are really only a state of apprehension. So if a group of observers, you know, perceive neutrino level perception, then they would have a very different experience. And let's say they don't perceive oceans and buildings and all this other kind of stuff. So maybe they perceive this as thermal equilibrium, and they like a parallel sort of universe or parallel sort of perceptions.
I don't think that's right, but we have to talk about it after I'm done because time is running out. I want to tell you why you ordinarily can think that you believe in the existence of Edwin Hubble in the Pacific Ocean and so forth. And it's because this is not your theory. So how do you ordinarily think of reconstructions of the past? Why do we trust them? The answer is because you implicitly assume a low entropy past boundary condition. And the combination of unitary evolution plus the desire to form reliable memories only works if you can also assume something else, and that something else is a past boundary condition. So let's imagine that you tried to invent a machine that would record something about the external world, but you did it according to the rules of quantum mechanics, according to unitary evolution. You could not have irreversible processes involved in your machine. So here's the outside world. It's one bit. This is a good freshman physics kind of thing. One bit for the outside world, one bit for your recording device. What you would like is to not disturb the outside world. It starts in state alpha and ends in state alpha. But whatever your state was in, it records state alpha. That is what you would like to form a memory of the outside world. The problem is there's no unitary transformation that does this. You can't go from two different states to one single state with two copies. That's just not unitary. The way to make it work, the way to successfully record a memory is to assume that you know the state of the recorder ahead of time. If you knew that the recording device was in state zero, you could call it without loss of generality, then you could hook up a unitary transformation such that if the universe was in state zero, you kept in state zero, and if the universe was in state one, you became in state one. And the way to make that unitary, you said, if your assumption were not correct, had the recording device been in state one, it would do the opposite of recording. It would have not alpha in it. And this is just a controlled not gate, you would call it in quantum computation theory, perfectly unitary and reversible. And the lesson is that in order to form a reliable memory by unitary evolution, you need to assume a low entropy past boundary condition. In fact, you can technically calculate the entropy. All you're saying is that the initial state of the recording device was a pure state. It had zero entropy. If it had maximal entropy, if it could have been anything, you could have gotten any result. And that's just a slightly fancy quantum mechanical way of saying that given any state here, if you don't know what's going on here, you can get anything down here in the past. The way to correctly extrapolate from here to there is to also assume something about the very past. There's only certain ways to get from a low entropy past to there, which would tell you something reliable then about the outside world. Therefore, well, the same thing yet again, I'm not going to say it. The upshot of all this is that in an ergodic universe, where the system cycles through every allowed state, and allowed means consistent with these conserved quantities in the description of the wave function, no amount of local knowledge tells us anything interesting about the rest of the universe. Given what I know locally, I can just put whatever I want in the rest of the universe. Every time you look out the window, it should look like thermal equilibrium, and therefore we conclude that that theory is not right. The universe is not wandering ergodically in some finite dimensional Hilbert space. And this would work for any theory with a discrete spectrum, not just a finite spectrum. More importantly, I think, there are two lessons. There's lessons for calculating probabilities in the multiverse. I still don't know how to calculate these probabilities. I'm very modest about these things. There's a lot of papers written, and I don't really can't have the ability to judge any of them. All I want to say is that assuming conditional typicality seems perfectly sensible. Assuming that given that we observe what we observe, we should be able to make predictions about the next thing we observe by assuming that we are typically situated among people who observe those things is fair. No one understood what that sentence was, but you knew ahead of time what I was going to say, so it's okay. We have nothing to say about Jovians, but we can say something about the multiverse given what we've already observed. Most interestingly for me, I think we can draw conclusions about the theory of everything. And this is sort of remarkable. If you want to understand the purported evolution of the universe in some context, then I think that this ergodic example doesn't work, but it was kind of a mild set of assumptions. Not necessarily true assumptions. Quantum mechanics, finite dimensional Hilbert space. So something there is wrong. What could it be? One possibility is the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. This is an obvious way which it could be wrong. If you believe in the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in canonical quantum gravity, then this notion of time evolution is only a semi-classical notion. The real equation is just that H annihilates the state. You hope that somewhere within superspace there are local coordinates that you can assemble into any internal clock so that locally in the vicinity of this trajectory you have a time-dependent evolution. That's what you hope to do, but there might be some point at which that description gives out. There might not be a universal time evolution. That's certainly possible. One of the reasons why I think that it's nevertheless possible that there is a universal time evolution is ADS-CFT. Here you have an example of the best understood explicit example of a theory of quantum gravity. ADS, M theory on ADS 5 cross S 5 is dual to a theory of a conformal field theory on a four-dimensional boundary that is just a field theory. It obeys the time-dependent Schrödinger equation with the time coordinate of the boundary. So again, this time coordinate need not have any simple interpretation in terms of local space-time quantities. Everything I said still goes through as long as there is some description of the state of the universe in which there is a time coordinate that lasts forever, and that does happen in this example. So I personally don't like this way of weaseling out of the conclusion. My favorite way is to... I'll probably skip that. No, I'll say that. My favorite way is to say that, in fact, the Hilbert space of the universe is not finite dimensional or even discrete. It's continuous. It's a very big universe. We have a lot of states in the universe. But the thing I want to end on is to emphasize that that's necessary if you believe in an eternal universe. It's necessary to believe that it's infinite dimensional, but it's not sufficient. By itself, you do not get out of these paradoxes of recurrence and entropy just by assuming an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. The classical analogy is if you have a finite box and it lasts forever, you will recur, you will go through every possible thing. If you don't have a finite box, you have an infinite space. And this is just a box of gas, not gravity or field theory or anything like that. If you have an infinite box of gas, but a finite density, so also an infinite number of particles, etc., all of the problems still exist. Even though there are an infinite number of degrees of freedom, locally you will, in fact, have all these fluctuations, and the measure on the space of fluctuations will be the same. You haven't solved any problems. My proposal for solving this problem is to imagine that we are the quantum mechanical equivalent of a small number of particles or a finite number of particles in an infinitely big space. And in that case, there is no equilibrium that you can reach. The way to get out of these nightmares of Nietzschean recurrence is to imagine that there is no equilibrium state that the universe ever gets into, that our local universe is just an offshoot of the big multiverse's attempts to increase its entropy without bounds. And I think that the project for the future, and hopefully papers will be coming out soon, is to take this kind of idea and give it a space-time interpretation in terms of actually creating universes that inflate and so forth. And I think that's my favorite way to get out of these puzzles. but I'm very impressed with the fact that you can go from fairly basic observations of what the universe would look like if it were a finite-dimensional Hilbert space to conclusions about the whole universe, and hopefully soon we'll get this whole predicting the multiverse thing all settled. Thank you.
I just wanted to say, I think the H equals zero picture, say for the Sitter space, mm-hmm. in the end sounds kind of like this last story. Anyway, you have a finite number of states, but you don't have recurrences. Or you can have a finite number of states without recurrences. And that's because
okay.
you don't have some fundamental time. Or
that's right. Okay, yes. And so I buy that is an open possibility. I personally don't like it, and my hidden agenda for not liking it, and I'm willing to be convinced otherwise, is that I don't see how I can explain the arrow of time in this setup, whereas I can in the other setup. But again, I'm willing to be convinced otherwise if someone can explain it.
If you go back to your slide where you introduced the second piece of data,
mm-hmm.
it seems like the key thing there, right, is that D1 has to not just include some previous piece of data, but it has to include all the data you've ever taken?
Yes.
Is that right?
I'm just following what Jim and Mark told me to do.
Okay. Because otherwise, if this is just some randomly chosen previous piece of data, I don't know how this keeps you from making the same kind of predictions about the existence of Jovians.
No, that's exactly right. So we're being given a recipe for dealing with the fact that we are one small set of people living in a big multiverse. And the recipe is, start with all the things you know about the universe, okay? If your theory predicts that all of those things will exist somewhere in the ensemble, then this factor for that theory is one. That's the statement. You are not allowed to separately make that statement for little subsets of things that you know, because then you could, in fact, say exactly. If you read, again, this is just a theorem. You can look it up, and you can't argue with it. So I'm arguing for something that is arguable, namely a way to deal with D1 and D2, which is not symmetric with respect to D1 and D2. You cannot pick and choose what's in there. In these words I've attached to it, D1 is everything we've already done, and D2 is the next thing we do.
Great.
Thanks.